You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest looks at Foxconn plans in the United States and beyond and says Foxconn isn't likely to deliver on its promises.
First, the Department of Education plans to change its approach to campus sexual misconduct, and it's starting an effort to overturn Obama-era policies. Here's Education Secretary Betsy DeVos speaking last week at George Mason University in Virginia.
One rape is one too many. One assault is one too many. One aggressive act of harassment is one too many. One person denied due process is one too many.
But DeVos said the Obama administration had put bad policies into place.
The truth is that the system established by the prior administration has failed too many students. Survivors, victims of a lack of due process, and campus administrators have all told me that the current approach does a disservice to everyone involved. That's why we must do better, because the current approach isn't working.
Vanessa Gregoriadis is a contributing editor at New York Times Magazine and Vanity Fair. She's the author of the book Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. She joins us to look at this change. Vanessa, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, on a practical level, from what we've heard from the Trump administration, what would change when it comes to federal involvement in campus sexual assault issues?
They want to change the campus courts. So they essentially want to cut those courts off at their knees. They want to change the standard of proof right now in order to be found responsible, which is the word that courts on campus like to use instead of guilty to make it sound more like a school thing. You must be 51% likely to have committed the assault. They would like to raise that standard of proof to something like 75%. They'd also like to move the cases entirely out of the schools. They may be interested in bringing in former criminal prosecutors to look at these cases.
And what do you make of those changes? What, based on the research you've done for this book, what do you think the impact of those changes could be?
Well, I do not support these changes because I believe that sexual assault is so hard to prove because of the consent defense. She wanted it. She consented to it. That's what almost every guy who is accused of sexual assault will say. So 51% is not a crazy standard of proof to have in a case like that. Let's remember, there's not a lot of physical evidence in these cases. What really concerns me, though, is the notion that former criminal prosecutors who are only interested in evidence will be brought to the fore here. We could really change by doing that what sexual assault means on campus. Right now, we are at a moment in our country where we are redefining sexual assault. We are saying Donald Trump is guilty not of groping, if he's indeed guilty of what some women accused him of after the Access Hollywood tape, he might be a sexual assaulter. Taylor Swift, who got her butt grabbed by a disc jockey, she might have been sexual assaulted. That wasn't just fair play. So what I really want to know is this new structure that Betsy DeVos is setting up, in those cases where there is no evidence, where it is only groping, yet where it is violating for a woman and not what a young woman who is in college to become a leader should have to suffer, what is she going to do about those cases? I don't think we've heard an answer about that.
Vanessa Gregoriadis is with us, author of the book Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus, looking at sexual assault issues on American campuses. And Vanessa, you talked to a lot of women and men on college campuses around the country. What did you learn, big picture, about what students were thinking about when it came to consent, sex, and sexual assault?
Students are really concerned about this issue, and they are just in line with the new thinking of a lot of liberals, to be honest. But they think that there should be new rules around sex on campus, that groping is sexual assault, that notions about ethical sex need to come in. Sex needs to be thoughtful. It needs to be compassionate. It needs to leave the other partner feeling more self-esteem instead of less. These are undergraduates. They think a lot about morality, you know. That age of post-adolescence is a time of really black and white moral thinking. And as universities have encouraged students to think about what sexual assault really is and the way it really can encompass a lot of offensive acts that women have for too long accepted as just boys will be boys and something that happens in the course of a night, they're there with those universities, and they are taking this incredibly seriously.
And you make the case for really embracing the idea of consent, moving to more of a yes means yes standard than a no means no standard alone.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth it to be frank about the cases that we're finding on campus. A lot of adults think that there are violent cases, violent penetration, gang rape, scary predators stalking our campuses. That, in my research, is just not the case. What we have are a lot of boys who need to learn what consent really means. And they need to understand in 2017, picking up a girl at a frat party who's wearing beer goggles because she's so drunk she's barely speaking English and taking that girl home, that's not cool. You know? That is not cool. You don't get a high five for that from your frat brothers the next morning. People on campus, students, now look at those guys and say, that guy's creepy. They may even say, that guy's a sexual assaulter. And you know what? No college guy wants to be that guy. So a lot of college guys are changing their behavior because they want to be seen as cool and upstanding in the realm of sex.
We've got a lot of campuses here in Wisconsin. What would be your advice to campus administrators, people who are setting policy on these issues?
I think the campus administrators need to take a really hard look at the way they're dealing with alcohol on their campuses. Alcohol is connected to sexual assault. They need to start saying to themselves, we have pushed alcohol off our campuses. You can't bring a keg in a dorm. My God, you'd be, you know, swiftly suspended for having a big party like that if you were a student. The schools don't want that liability. So where do they push alcohol? Into unsupervised fraternity basements. And I'm not saying that all frats are bad. Some frats are great, but there's always the bad frat. There's always a couple, maybe, of bad frats. And you've got young girls going into situations that are really dangerous. And the university itself is contributing to that.
And finally, can you give advice first for, you know, there are a lot of college freshmen out there and men and women, advice for the men on campus and then the women on campus?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say, you know, the first thing for parents to know, and I really did write this book for parents to learn how to protect their daughters from being assaulted and their sons from being accused. The first thing to know is, you know, this isn't necessarily going to happen. You don't need to be afraid, but what you need to tell your kids is that, say, alcohol is drunk in moderation. That actually joining clubs is a good thing if you're a woman. Being part of a sports team is a good thing. joining a sorority may even be a good thing, because the more social capital you have, the more you're connected to important events on campus, the less vulnerable you are to men picking on you.
We'll leave it there, Vanessa. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Vanessa Gregoriadis is the author of the book Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, CNN reports that President Trump has invited more Democrats than Republicans to the White House this week. We'll look at efforts at bipartisanship in the Trump era.
First, a $3 billion incentive deal for Foxconn is well on its way to clearing the state legislature. The Taiwanese tech manufacturer has pledged to bring 13,000 jobs to Wisconsin and open one or possibly two manufacturing facilities.
But our next guest says there's reason to be skeptical about Foxconn's promises and the benefits the company could bring to Wisconsin. Lawrence Tabak investigated conditions at the Foxconn plant in Indiana and reports on Foxconn plants in China and Japan as well.
Lawrence joins us now. Lawrence Tabak is a Madison-based writer. He wrote about Foxconn for BeltMag.com. Lawrence, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you wanted to get a clearer picture about what Wisconsin could realistically expect from Foxconn. So you started at the Indiana plant. Tell us, let's start with the facility. What kind of facility does Foxconn have there?
It's the largest current plant they have in the United States, with about 900 employees. Although when it was being constructed, they promised 1,400, which might tell you a little bit about their predictive abilities. But it's a plant that I think sheds some important light on what might be happening in Wisconsin, because the best way to know what is going to be in your future is to look at what's in the past.
And you spoke with a couple of former workers who were at that Indiana plant. What did they have to say to you?
Well, one of the most striking things that they described was the fact that the facility was being operated with a large percentage of undocumented workers. And of course, this was a little shocking to hear, but this was confirmed by other people that worked there, as well as sort of a consistent flow of messages on job boards. So it's important to note that these were not Foxconn employees, but rather employees that Foxconn used that were channeled through employment agencies.
So in your piece, you describe this as an example. You see it as Foxconn distancing itself from the practice of employing workers who were undocumented.
Well, I think that's the only way to look at it. I mean, clearly when half the workforce didn't show up on certain days when there was a rumor of a immigration raid, I'm pretty sure that the managers there were aware of why that was.
And let's talk about the conditions in the plant. You found out at least one report about the conditions being uncomfortable, is maybe a mild word, in hot, really hot weather, no air conditioning.
Yeah, that was very striking. When I talked to a gentleman who had started at the plant working on the assembly line, and he recalled his most impressionable moment was the memory of working on that line in hot Indiana summers with Foxconn not providing any air conditioning for all the workers.
And did you hear any other stories about what the conditions were like for workers, what morale was like, and why maybe that these two individuals left?
Well, one thing that's striking is that the Foxconn formula is the same everywhere in the world. And we've all heard, I think, about some of the sad news of worker abuse in China, but that's easy to sort of brush off by saying it's a different culture, they have different labor laws. But they have the same basic conditions in plants all throughout Europe, and not maybe that surprisingly, in their Indiana plant as well. And basically, it's a system where people work to a very, very strict routine. There's a measurement for everything they do, so that you have X number of seconds to put in each screw into the assembly line, and it's relentless. They love 10, 12-hour shifts, although they do give two 15-minute breaks and a half hour for lunch.
And the workers you talked to at Foxconn, they were no longer employed there. I mean, is it possible that you spoke with disgruntled workers who are more likely to give you a negative picture of things?
Well, we were certainly aware of that possibility, and one of the things that made me more confident is that as I talked to these people, they volunteered the same information about the details, so that it seemed hardly likely to be fabricated or certainly not coincidental.
Now, there's also a Foxconn plant in China, and you write about this. This plant in particular had some, I guess, bad publicity in the beginning. They saw a rash of worker suicides there. What do we know about why workers may have killed themselves in China and what Foxconn did about it?
Well, there's other sources for this, and it's easy to find if anyone is interested in researching, but the history is pretty appalling of worker abuse in China, and from all evidence, these were just workers who were taken to the limit and jumped off of high-rise dormitories that are on site at some of these factories that employ hundreds of thousands of workers. And as one of my sources said about the Indiana plant, he said they treat, this is they being Foxconn, treats employees as disposable. And perhaps that explains the distress of some of the workers who went to such extremes.
Now, Foxconn has been billed as a chance to bring family-supporting jobs to Wisconsin. Based on what you saw, does that seem like a fair assessment of what you found in terms of the salaries paid?
Well, the type of jobs that I'm describing in Indiana are assembly jobs, and the type of jobs that are likely to be most evident, at least prominent, at the new factory building LCD panels are much higher-level jobs, higher-skiller jobs, technical jobs that require some college education, likely engineering degrees. But what we did is we took a look at the plant in Sake, Japan, which is virtually identical to the one that they're proposing in Wisconsin, and we said, well, how many of these workers are there in that plant? Because how else will you know how many they're going to need here? And it turns out that plant was operational with 1,000 employees. So that 13,000 just doesn't match up with what you would need to run a plant that requires those kinds of skills.
I'm talking to Lawrence Tabak right now, Madison-based writer. He wrote about Foxconn for BeltMag magazine, BeltMag.com, I should say. And Lawrence, in terms of what to expect, you know, this has been, you know, manufacturing has taken a hit in the Midwest, taken a hit in Wisconsin as well as Indiana, where you were earlier. And I wonder if you think Wisconsin is in a position to be turning away jobs. These might not be jobs that are the knight in shining armor that could come in and rescue Wisconsin's manufacturing industry, but do they have the potential to help families and to turn Wisconsin's economy for the good?
I don't think anyone would gainsay that. And if Foxconn had come to Wisconsin to build a plant without billions of dollars of subsidies, it wouldn't be an issue, would it? The real issue is the cost involved in bringing these jobs and doubt that exists about whether they will multiply themselves into more and more jobs as the economic impact studies that were paid for by Foxconn indicate. It's just not likely that manufacturing is sort of a viral activity in which if you have one, more just start popping up around it.
And talking about opportunities for advancement, we haven't gotten to that subject matter yet. Did you see evidence that there was upward mobility at these plants? I know a concern you raise is, you heard from these workers, is it didn't seem like they were able to move upward in the ranks at Foxconn.
Well, that's something I think that may be shocking to Wisconsin workers if this plant comes to fruition, and that is the prevalence of Asian managers and Asian engineers if they follow the same model they do elsewhere in the world.
Including the U.S.?
Including in the U.S. We discovered that there was a steady flow of visa engineers coming into the Indiana plant. So the opportunities for U.S. workers will be likely limited by that culture that has a preference for a Chinese or Asian-based managers and higher-level executives.
And based on the number of jobs that are expected to arrive in Wisconsin with part of this Foxconn deal, would you expect a proportion of that to be given to people who weren't from Wisconsin, based on what you saw?
Well, there's certainly, I think, a likelihood that there will be a lot of Asian engineers and managers on site, And part of what Wisconsin will be paying for, I don't think people have really realized this, will be the construction project that includes apartment living for those people on site. So that instead of having a lot of higher paid engineers living in the community, they're going to be living on site.
You said you were amazed that people hadn't taken a closer look at some of the places you looked at, the factory in Indiana, in China, in Japan, to get a sense of what was most likely to play out here in Wisconsin. Why do you think it wasn't looked at the way you looked at it?
Well, and you know, that's an excellent question, and one of the ones we raised when we wrote the story. But I think a lot of it has to do with sort of the psychological factors that come into play when you get this excited about a project. Clearly, the image of a slew, thousands of new jobs, was intoxicating to the people involved. And the fact that once you get to that state of excitement, especially in a competitive environment where you're bidding against other states, you start to suffer from what we call confirmation bias, which is you only look for positive things and you have a psychological mental block against negative things.
And it's about to, it looks poised, the Foxconn deal to clear the state legislature. Is this something you expect to pass? And what are you looking for next?
Well, by all accounts, it's going to pass. The question is what will actually happen once ground is broken, if it is broken. And I think that's something that we should all be keeping a very close eye on.
Lawrence, thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Tabak is a Madison-based writer, and he wrote about Foxconn for BeltMag.com.
Coming up, we'll look at bipartisanship in the Trump era with a deal on the debt ceiling and hurricane relief, maybe a deal in the works on DACA between President Trump and leading congressional Democrats. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tomorrow morning after 6 on The Joy Cardine Show, Tell Joy Where to Go. This week, Joy's guests share some hidden gems to see around Wisconsin, and you can call in with your favorite travel destinations off the beaten path. That's tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, after a week of high-profile meetings with Democratic leaders, President Trump has crossed party lines to make deals on some big issues. Last week, he sided with House and Senate minority leaders, respectively Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, on a 3-month deal to raise the debt ceiling. Republican leaders objected to that 3-month extension.
Last night, the president met with Pelosi and Schumer again to work on the broad strokes of legislation that would give legal status to so-called Dreamers, who are undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. CNN reports that President Trump has invited more Democrats to the White House than Republicans in the past week.
These meetings with Democrats came up yesterday in the daily press briefing. Here's what White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, starting with why voters elected President Trump.
They were sick and tired of business as usual. They wanted somebody who would break up the status quo, that would bring people from both sides of the table together to have conversations. This president's done more for bipartisanship in the last 8 days than Obama did in 8 years.
Elaine K. Mark is a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at Brookings Institution and the author of Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. She joins us to look at bipartisanship in the era of Trump. Elaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Well, let's take on that statement we just heard from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, saying that President Trump has done more to advance bipartisanship than President Obama did in 8 years. What do you think about that remark?
I think it would be true and admirable if, in fact, there was any thought or strategy behind the president's dealings. It is very clear from the news report that his first attempt at bipartisanship was done basically on the spur of the moment and surprised Pelosi and Schumer as much as it surprised his own colleagues, McConnell and Ryan. And that is the problem here. The problem is not bipartisanship, which everybody kind of likes and could get behind. The problem is that you never know what this president is going to do. So we don't know how long this little love affair with the Democrats will last. And given how polarized the two parties are, and given what a polarized campaign President Trump ran, it is entirely possible that this is just going to blow up in his face as his base and his party abandons him.
Well, the president has changed course. This was not his tactic in the first, 7 months of his presidency. And now working with Democrats. It's a shift for him. Do you think that this is in a sense, though, what President Trump pledged to do? He pledged to shake things up and to make deals. He's considered a consummate deal maker. And if that means reaching across the aisle, even if his own party is ticked off, that's what he's going to do. Is it fair to see it that way?
Well, I think he certainly promised to make deals. The problem is that he also promised a whole lot of things to his base that Democrats aren't going to make deals about. So believe me, when he said that he was going to get rid of DACA, the plan to let immigrants' children stay here who were brought here through no fault of their own, when he said that, his base took it to mean that he wasn't going to let this happen anymore. But in fact, what it looks like he's now telling people it means is, I was going to repeal it and then we're going to do some legislation to make it permanent. So the problem with, there's no problem with making deals except that he's so far out on so many issues that he's in a sort of lose-lose situation. He's either going to completely change his mind and come towards the Democrats on some very, very testy things like immigration, or he's going to further blow up the Republican Party. Since the Democrats are the minority, they can't deliver for him, the majority. So he's got to worry about his own party.
Can you define blow up the Republican Party?
Well, the Republican Party has had a lot of internal strife ever since 2015 when Trump, came into the field. There is a part of the Republican Party that some people call it the alt-right or the extreme right that has very hardcore positions on a bunch of issues. Trump really got their support during the primaries. He was able to beat a lot of better known and more qualified Republican candidates and came into the White House really on the wings of a faction of his political party. Now, those people are expecting that he's going to deliver for them. And if he doesn't, if he starts reversing course, as he appears to have done this morning, well, they're going to be really mad. Now, I think it's great that, he's going to work with Democrats to get some legislation for these kids who were brought here when they were young and don't know any other home but the United States. I think it's great. But boy, oh boy, I think there's a lot of people who voted for him who are going to have a different opinion. And they're in the House, at least, they're not going to vote for a deal.
In terms of getting his own party to fall into line, is this an effective tool? They're effectively sidelined while the president is eating, by what I hear in CNN, Chinese food and chocolate pie with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, and they're on the outside looking in. Could this bring them into line for him?
I don't think so. It depends on the substance of the deal reached, right? And, you got to go back to this Donald Trump, the consummate deal maker. He was a deal maker in real estate. Now, I would never presume, as a political scientist and a professor, right, I wouldn't presume to negotiate a real estate deal because I don't know anything about it. What we saw in healthcare is that Donald Trump doesn't have enough depth in policy to actually get in and negotiate things. And I think that's going to be the same way here. So I don't know that I think this consummate deal maker is a bit of nonsense, frankly, because you can't be a consummate deal maker if you have no substantive depth. So the question is, if he is, quote, dealing with Pelosi and Schumer, what happens? Does he cave? either wittingly or unwittingly because he just doesn't know enough? Or is he actually able to get a good deal? He certainly flopped on health care. And a lot of that was just he didn't know enough. He didn't understand the intricacies of that market and that system.
On the other hand, I mean, he is moving legislation, moving things forward. We've got DACA, we've got the debt ceiling that he did a deal with Democrats. And maybe it's not about victories, but maybe it's ending gridlock.
Well, that would be very nice. And the debt ceiling deal, so to speak, was particularly important because it's been absurd that for the last several years, a small group in the House has basically held up our entire government and never succeeded at it, but keeps doing it again and again and again, and threatened that the U.S. would default on its debt. This could be a really important deal going forward, particularly if they can just get rid of this debt ceiling business once and for all. So I think it will be. But here's the rub. I mean, every time we think that Donald Trump is going in a certain direction or we think he's acting like a normal president, he does it for a while and then he reverses himself. So, you know, the back and forth on Charlottesville where he said some pretty outrageous things. Everybody said, boy, that's terrible. Then he gave a very presidential speech from a teleprompter. And then two nights later, he went to Phoenix and was, you know, unhinged again. So the problem is that the president has not shown himself to have a steady hand or a steady leadership style. And it's hurting him.
We're talking with Elaine Kmark now from the Brookings Institution about bipartisanship under President Trump.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What is your take on President Trump's meetings and dealings with Democratic leaders over the last week? Are you happy to see this happening? Do you think this could be a sign of more bipartisan cooperation and of gridlock in Washington? Or are you worried about it? Did you vote for President Trump? Is this exactly what you wanted not to see from him? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now about bipartisanship in the Trump era with Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the deal making between President Trump on one hand and then Democratic leaders of their parties in Congress on the other on the debt ceiling, hurricane relief and a government budget? Apparently a deal partly in the works on DACA and deportation. Maybe the wall gets thrown in there. Is this what you wanted to see from the president? Is it what you didn't want to see from the president? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Jim joining us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks. I mean, we all have our attitudes and perceptions of Donald Trump as president. I'm not going to convey mine. But the truth objectively of Donald Trump is that we have a president who never held any elected office in his life. And what we really have is amateur hour. We have a person who's trying to learn to do the job, you know, on the job, and he's the president of the United States. We saw a little bit of this with Governor Jesse Ventura of Minnesota, but that was a much less significant position. So I'm not going to say what I think of Donald Trump. I'd just be interested in your guest comments and my attitude about that point. Thank you.
All right, Jim, thanks for that. And sounds pretty familiar, Elaine. You were saying that the president thought wasn't skilled in the art of politics. He didn't have the depth of knowledge.
No, he doesn't. And the caller, I mean, it's interesting the caller should mention Jesse Ventura because I often mention Jesse Ventura in talking about the president. Periodically, we get these, wonderfully charismatic candidates who you know, tap into some reservoir of anger, hope, et cetera, in the electorate, get elected. And then what happens is they tend to fall pretty flat on their faces because they don't have the political skills and knowledge to actually turn the expectations of their voters into reality. And so that, I think, is what a lot of people fear for Donald Trump, is he's just not going to be able to deliver what he promised people he would.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. And we're going to go next to Anna in Waukesha. Anna, hi.
Hi. So I had briefly mentioned that I thought it was very interesting, you know, that we brought up the fact that the alt-right really did put Donald Trump in office. And we're seeing this sashaying of Trump going between his Republican ideals and then Democratic ideals. And everyone thinks that it's different. But the fact is, this is what Donald Trump was like before he even ran. I mean, he would go from Democratic ideals to Republican ideals. There's interviews where he supports the war, where he's against the war, where he's for paid maternity leave, where he's against it. And, you know, we're now seeing that with him as a president. And I truly do believe with your guest that, you know, we're kind of seeing him almost grasping at straws. It's like he's the dog that's going between people at the dinner table trying to get a treat and trying to appease everyone. And personally, I mean, I didn't vote for Trump. I was very much for Bernie Sanders, so it was obviously a very drastic change for me to see someone like the Donald in office. But it's harrowing to see it as not just a Democrat, but just as a person that, you know, our presidency is in the hands of a man who I don't think he even knows.
Anna, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. And Anna basically saying, if you're surprised, then you haven't been paying attention. She says this is what Donald Trump has been like. And also, you know, this is what Republicans have feared, that Donald Trump would get into office and might cut deals that betrayed Republican conservative ideals.
Oh, Anna's really hit the nail on the head here. He was all over the place before he ran for office. Then when he ran, and Steve Bannon had a great deal to do with this, it's recounted in the latest book about Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon gave him sort of a coherent platform, if you will. It was an alt-right ideology, and as he became more and more famous, as he got closer to his goal of the nomination and then the general, he really articulated that platform, which terrified a lot of people like Anna, who voted for Bernie Sanders and others. And I think that a lot of people, sort of mainstream Republicans, ended up voting for Trump because, first of all, they didn't like Hillary Clinton. That's another story. But secondly, because they thought it was kind of an act. You know, they thought that somehow he'd get into office and he'd, on places where you expect a president to act like a president, he would. Well, interestingly enough, that we're now nine months into this, and it really hasn't happened yet. And I think that has a lot of people worried.
Anna, thanks so much for the call. And another quick one we've got here from Peter in Madison. Peter, hello.
Hi. I think it's okay if Chuck Schumer, in this particular case, we can work something out with Trump to help the DACA recipients out. I think that's okay. But in general, I don't think it's a good strategy for the Democrats to focus on bipartisanship and trying to cheapen their brand by working with the Republicans. What they should be advocating for and what they should be putting forward as policy proposals, I don't think align with what the Republicans would be on board with at all.
Peter, I'm going to leave it there. We're a little short of time. And Elaine, what do you think about what Peter said, that Democrats, maybe they shouldn't be so willing to sit down at the table with President Trump? Maybe there's something that could damage them in the future.
Well, I don't think Democrats are going to make any big concessions to Donald Trump. I mean, I think that they are absolutely in opposition to most of what he ran on. But as the caller said, there are some areas, like the debt ceiling, where the Democrats absolutely wanted that. The Republicans were against it, and suddenly Trump switched positions. So I think that the Democrats can, you know, deal with the president to the extent that they stay clear in their own positions and true to their own principles. But if they start giving in or compromising with Donald Trump, I think they're going to have a lot of trouble.
Elaine,
and frankly, I don't think they'll do it in the end.
Elaine, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Elaine Kmark, Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution and the author of the book Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. She joined us there to talk about the prospect of bipartisanship under President Trump.
been nearly 30 years since special environmental protections were put in for a 92-mile stretch of the lower Wisconsin River from Prairie du Sac to roughly Prairie du Chien. By most accounts, the river bluffs and water in the main channel are in good shape. But scientists are increasingly concerned about the backwaters of the river because of excessive growth of algae and other vegetation. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Just off Highway 60, east of Spring Green, hydrogeologist Ken Wade is taking the cap off the top of a pipe. The vertical pipe is a monitoring well, one of three here that Wade checks to keep track of the quality of the groundwater. Wade and another hydrogeologist, Dave Marshall, then take a water sample and test it with a meter. Marshall gives the reading.
It's going to be roughly between 15 and 16 milligrams per liter nitrogen.
That's bad, says Marshall, as the nitrate level is likely contributing to a problem about 100 feet to the south in a lower Wisconsin River backwater called Jones Slough. Marshall moves to the edge of the slough and looks at the green and brown carpet of vegetation.
You see very little open water. Some days you see absolutely no open water, and that's because of the dense growths of filamentous algae and duckweed.
Marshall explains that here in the river valley, a lot of nitrogen, including that found in manure, is put on nearby farm crops that are grown on mostly sandy soil. He contends too much nitrogen is applied, and a lot of it leaches into the groundwater, which flows into the sloughs. Marshall says the excessive plant growth is found in many of the 100 or so backwaters along the lower Wisconsin, including Crusan Slough near the village of Lone Rock. Marshall and Ken Wade head out on Crusan in a small boat. It's a bigger water body and farther from potential nitrogen sources, so the nitrate level isn't as bad. But Marshall says the contamination has been growing in recent years.
Historically, these shallow oxbow lakes were very clear and weedy, and that's just ideal fish and wildlife habitat. But now, we're seeing a shift.
Marshall says not only is recreational fishing less pleasant in many of the sloughs, but rare fish species like the starhead top minnow are at risk. He also says during floods, the backwaters can carry contaminants into the main river channel. Ken Wade says he and his colleague, both retired from the DNR and now active with the Friends of the Lower Wisconsin Riverway, are setting the stage for potential action on the nitrogen issue.
We are defining the problems and giving enough detail so even if we don't have an immediate solution, people will understand what the problem is.
DNR water resources specialist Gene Unmuth also studies the lower Wisconsin sloughs and calls them jewels or pearls in the landscape. She says agriculture is not the only source of contaminants.
There are impacts from runoff from cities and villages, as well as people that, fertilize their lawns that live along some of these sloughs. So rather than point the finger at just agricultural producers, we need to work as a whole.
Still, Unmuth says there are things farmers can do to reduce the flow of polluted groundwater. But she says in many cases, such action is voluntary, and it's up to state policymakers to decide otherwise. The executive director of the Lower Wisconsin Riverway Board, Mark Kupp, says those policymakers may want to consider the economic benefits of a clean river.
Because we're within 4.5 hour drive of 20 million people, and it's beautiful here. And it's important that we protect these places, including the backwaters.
The Friends group says the sloughs is one of the issues that will be discussed at a two-day State of the Riverway Symposium being held in Spring Green beginning Saturday. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are three different health care efforts in the U.S. Senate, single payer, an Affordable Care Act fix, or a revival of the repeal and replace effort. Our guest helps us sort out the policy debate.
We'll meet a championship arm wrestler from the Wausau area and find out how she competed in an international competition in Hungary this week.
And on Food Friday, great advice for making sweet potatoes.
It's all coming up tomorrow, plus a look at the day's news on Central Time.